A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote in with one of those questions that sounds like a pub argument until you actually try to answer it. He wants to know what the most consistently cold environment on Earth is, where a natural human population lives. Not a research station, not a military base. And he's not asking about the lowest annual mean temperature. He's asking about the place with the most days per year, so extremely cold that surviving them would be hard for anyone not adapted to it. Then he wants to know how the locals actually pull it off.
Four questions bundled into one. Where is it? How do we define the metric? What place fits? And how do they survive?
Right. And to answer any of them, we have to throw out the usual temperature rankings. The lowest recorded temperature on Earth is minus 89.2 Celsius at Vostok Station in Antarctica. Nobody lives there permanently. The coldest inhabited place by annual mean is usually given as Oymyakon in Siberia, around minus 16 Celsius. But Oymyakon has summers. It hit 30 degrees Celsius this July.
30 degrees. That's the thing. Oymyakon gets these brutal winter plunges. Minus 67 was recorded there, but the cold comes in bursts. A few days of truly savage cold, then it eases. The annual mean gets dragged down by the extremes, but the day-to-day experience isn't consistently lethal.
So Daniel's instinct to define consistently cold differently is the right one. He's asking about frequency of extreme conditions, not the mathematical average.
And the metric we need is basically this. How many days per year does the ambient condition, factoring wind, make it so? An unprotected person would be in serious trouble within minutes. The Canadian Wind Chill Index says exposed skin freezes in under 2 minutes at minus 40 Celsius with a 10 kilometer per hour wind. That's the threshold we're working with. Not it's unpleasant, it's your skin dies.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. And the place that racks up the most days above that threshold, with an actual natural human population that's been there for thousands of years, is Quianuc, Greenland.
Population about 646.
646 people at 77 degrees north, on the northwest coast of Greenland. The sun doesn't rise above the horizon for 4 months, October 25th to February 17th. Average February high is minus 20 Celsius. Average low is minus 29. But the wind is what makes it. The wind off the sea ice pushes the effective temperature below minus 40 for weeks at a time. Not days. Weeks.
So, Oymyakon has the colder floor. Kianaak has the colder ceiling.
Oymyakon drops further but bounces back. Quianuc just sits there, month after month, at a baseline that would kill you. And the Inuguit, the local Inuit subgroup, have lived there continuously for about 4,500 years.
Let's eliminate the other candidates before we go deeper. Eureka in Nunavut is colder, but it's a weather station. Thule Air Base is right nearby, but Daniel explicitly excluded military installations.
And there are a few settlements in northern Siberia that get close. Verkhoyansk, Dilyankir, but they still have that continental climate pattern where the cold spikes and retreats. Kiaunaak is maritime Arctic. The sea ice moderates the absolute lows, but keeps the cold locked in place. It doesn't swing.
The sensation of being in that kind of cold is hard to describe if you haven't felt it. The air burns. Not metaphorically, your nasal passages feel like they're being seared. Any exposed skin goes numb, then hard, then white. Your breath freezes on your face covering. And within 10 minutes, you've got a sheet of ice pressed against your mouth. At minus 40 with wind, your corneas can start to freeze if you don't squint.
Corneal freezing is a real risk. The tear film crystallizes. People who work outside in those conditions develop a specific squint. It's not just a facial expression, it's a survival reflex. And the thing about Quianuc is that this isn't a bad week. This is October through February.
So, how do you survive it? Daniel's fourth question. Start with what you wear.
The traditional Inuit clothing system is, honestly, one of the most sophisticated pieces of material engineering humans have ever developed. And I don't mean that in a romantic ancient wisdom way. I mean the physics of it checks out.
Caribou skin parka.
Two layers. The outer layer has the fur facing out. The guard hairs are hollow, which traps air, and they're stiff enough to shed wind. The inner layer has the fur facing in against the skin, creating a trapped air layer that your body heats. The hollow hairs are the key. Each caribou hair is a tube filled with air. The R value, the measure of thermal resistance, is comparable to high-end synthetic insulation, but with a crucial difference.
Breathability.
Breathability. If you sweat in minus 40 and the moisture can't escape, it freezes inside your clothing. Now you're wearing a refrigeration unit. Synthetics have gotten much better at this, but caribou skin still outperforms most of them in the specific combination of insulation and moisture transport needed at those temperatures.
And the boots.
Sealskin. Sealskin is naturally waterproof because of the oil content in the hide. It's also flexible at temperatures where rubber cracks and synthetic membranes stiffen into boards. The boots, comics, are stitched with sinew, which swells when wet, sealing the stitch holes. Every part of the system is optimized for this exact environment.
There's also the Amorti, the parka design with the built-in pouch for carrying infants. The baby is against the mother's back, inside the same thermal envelope. The hood is oversized so the mother can pull it forward, and the baby gets fresh air without being exposed.
And the engineering detail that gets me, the Amati, has a specific cut at the shoulders that lets the mother shift the baby from back to front for feeding without ever exposing the child to the outside air. That's not just clothing. That's a life support system for a newborn in an environment where exposure would kill an infant in minutes.
Clothing gets you through the first hour. What about the first month?
Shelter. And this is where a common misconception needs to be dealt with immediately. Inuit don't live in igloos year-round.
The igloo is a temporary hunting shelter.
It's a portable, rapidly deployable structure for when you're out on the ice. The permanent traditional home was the Cormac, a sod house built partially into the ground with walls of stone and turf, roofed with driftwood and more sod. The thermal mass of the earth and the insulation of the sod kept the interior surprisingly stable.
And the igloo itself. The physics of snow as insulation is worth a moment.
Fresh snow is mostly trapped air. Compacted into blocks for an igloo, the R value is comparable to fiberglass insulation. A properly built igloo, with a sleeping platform raised above the cold air that pools at the floor, can maintain an interior temperature just above freezing using only body heat and a small oil lamp. When it's minus 40 outside,
50 degree temperature differential from a pile of frozen water.
The sleeping platform is the clever bit. Cold air sinks. The entrance tunnel is dug lower than the floor, so it acts as a cold trap. The sleeping platform is the highest point in the structure where the warm air collects. You're sleeping in the thermal high ground.
Modern Kayak homes are heated wooden structures with oil stoves, which brings us to the logistics of fuel.
Heating oil in Kianak costs about $8 to $10 per gallon. In the continental U.S., it's around $3. A single home burns 500 gallons or more per winter. That's $4,000 to $5,000 just to not freeze, in a place where the median income isn't high. And the fuel has to get there by ship during the brief summer window when the sea ice opens, or by air. Every gallon you burn in February arrived 6 months earlier.
And if the shipment is late or short, you ration.
Or you burn seal oil, which people still do. The traditional soapstone lamp, the kulik, burns seal blubber. It provides heat and light, and it's been the center of the Inuit home for millennia. The kulik was traditionally tended by women, and the flame was never allowed to go out. A home without fire in that environment is a death sentence.
So clothing and shelter are the first two layers. The third is food.
The Inukwit diet is almost entirely animal-based. Seal, walrus, narwhal, polar bear, arctic char, seabirds. This isn't a preference. Plant life is essentially absent for 8 months of the year. There's no agriculture at 77 degrees north.
And the high fat content isn't a bug.
It's the engine. Seal blubber provides about 50% of daily calories during the winter. Fat metabolism generates more body heat per gram than carbohydrate metabolism. It's thermogenesis at the cellular level. You're literally burning fuel to stay warm, and the fuel is seal fat.
There's also the vitamin C question. The classic narrative is that sailors got scurvy because they had no fresh fruit. But the Inuit diet has no plant sources and no scurvy.
Raw meat and organ meat contain vitamin C. Cooking destroys it, which is why sailors on cook ship biscuit diets got scurvy. The Inuit practice of eating meat raw, frozen fish, aged seal meat, narwhal skin, preserves the vitamin C content. Muktuk, which is whale skin and blubber, has about 36 milligrams of vitamin C per 100 grams. That's comparable to orange juice.
Raw frozen fish has a name. Igunak.
Igunak is a specific preparation. The fish is caught, allowed to ferment slightly, then frozen. The fermentation breaks down the proteins and makes nutrients more bioavailable. It's an acquired taste, but it's also a precisely calibrated food preservation technology developed over thousands of years.
I want to stay on the food for a moment, because there's a misconception that the Inuit diet is unhealthy. All that fat, no vegetables. But it's metabolically optimized for this exact environment. You take someone from a temperate climate, put them on that diet without the cold exposure, and yes, they'd have problems. But the cold changes the metabolic equation entirely.
The caloric requirement alone is staggering. Someone working outside in Kaynak in February might burn 6,000 calories a day just maintaining body temperature. The high-fat diet isn't excessive. It's barely adequate.
Those are the material adaptations. Clothing, shelter, food. But there's another layer Daniel's question points to, and it's the one that's harder to quantify.
The knowledge system.
The Inuit have a concept, Kimuksik, that roughly translates to the shared knowledge of ice conditions, weather prediction, animal behavior. It's passed down orally. It's not written down because writing it down would be less useful than learning it from someone who's been on the ice for 60 years.
The specific thing that fascinates me is ice reading. Sea ice isn't uniform. It has different colors, textures, thicknesses, ages. First-year ice behaves differently from multi-year ice. Ice that looks solid can be rotten, weakened by currents from below. Reading ice correctly is the difference between bringing home a seal and falling through and dying in under 3 minutes.
And the dog sled, the Kamutik, is still essential. Not as a charming traditional holdover, as a practical tool that outperforms the modern alternative.
Snowmobiles fail in extreme cold. Engines won't start. Metal becomes brittle and cracks. Batteries die. Fuel gels. A dog team doesn't care. The dogs are adapted to the cold. They sleep outside at minus 40, curled up with their tails over their noses. They can navigate ice conditions by instinct. And if something goes wrong, you can eat the dogs. You can't eat a snowmobile.
That's dark.
It's practical. The dogs are working animals, and in a genuine survival situation, they become food. The relationship between an Inuit hunter and his dog team isn't sentimental in the way a suburban pet owner's relationship is. It's a partnership for mutual survival, and the terms are understood by both parties.
There was an incident in 2018 that made this painfully clear. The sea ice failed to form properly that winter. It was too thin for the dog sleds to reach the seal hunting grounds. Hunters were trapped in the settlement. The community faced real food shortages because the entire subsistence system depends on stable sea ice.
And that's the vulnerability, the whole adaptation package. The clothing, the shelter, the diet, the knowledge, the dogs, it all assumes a certain kind of winter. When the winter changes, the system cracks.
Which brings us to the deepest layer, the one you can't learn or build.
Biological adaptation. There was a study published in 2019 that looked at the genetics of cold adaptation in Inuit populations. The Inuit and other Inuit groups have genetic variants that increase basal metabolic rate and alter how fat is metabolized. They generate more body heat from the same caloric intake compared to non-adapted populations.
So it's not just that they eat more fat. Their bodies do more with it.
Right. And there's the body morphology. Bergman's rule, the biological principle that cold-adapted populations tend to have shorter limbs and stockier builds. This reduces the surface area to volume ratio, which reduces heat loss. Allen's rule adds that extremities get shorter, shorter fingers, shorter ears, flatter faces, less surface area exposed to the cold.
These are adaptations that took thousands of years. You can't acquire them by moving there.
You can't. And this is why the question of how do they survive has a multi-layered answer. There's the technology layer, the clothing, the shelter, the dog sleds. There's the knowledge layer, how to read ice, how to predict weather, where the seals will be, And there's the biological layer, the metabolic and morphological adaptations that make the technology and knowledge effective.
If I move to Canada tomorrow with a truck full of the best cold weather gear on the market, I'd still be in serious trouble.
You'd be. The gear helps, but the knowledge gap would kill you before the biological gap had a chance. You wouldn't know which ice was safe. You wouldn't know the signs of a coming storm. You wouldn't know how to manage moisture in your clothing. You'd make a mistake, and in that environment, one mistake is all it takes.
The mistake budget in Kyanak is zero.
Essentially, zero. And that's what consistently cold really means. It's not just the temperature, it's the margin for error. In a temperate climate, you can forget your coat and be uncomfortable. In Kyanak in February, you forget your face covering and you lose your nose.
Carhartt Extremes Arctic Parka, $499. 1998.
Go on.
I spent a winter in Kyanak that year, working as a dog sled mechanic for a documentary crew. I grew up in Minnesota. I thought I knew cold. I didn't know cold.
Failed first.
The Gore-Tex froze solid, became a stiff shell that cracked at the elbows. My synthetic boots wicked sweat. The sweat froze, and I got frostbite on three toes. The Inuit hunters watched me limping around for 2 days, then one of them handed me a sealskin parka and a pair of kamiks without saying a word.
They'd seen this before.
They see it every time someone shows up with the best gear from the catalog. The caribou parka they gave me. I asked how old it was. The hunter said his grandmother made it. He was about 50. The stitching was still perfect. The sealskin boots had been resoled twice. They were older than me.
The material knowledge is the thing. It's not traditional wisdom in some vague sense. It's precise engineering.
Caribou fur has hollow hairs. Each hair is a tube of trapped air. No synthetic insulation in 1998 matched the warmth-to-weight ratio at minus 40. I don't know if any does now. Sealskin is waterproof because of the oil content in the hide. You can't replicate that with a membrane. The oil is part of the material.
Hoa, did your toes recover?
Two of them. The third one's still numb when it gets cold, which is most of the time.
The detail that I keep coming back to. The hunters could tell the temperature by the sound of the snow under the sled runners.
Specific squeak at minus 30. Different crunch at minus 40. Below minus 45, it goes silent. The snow is too hard to compress. They'd call it out without looking at a thermometer. I tried to learn it. Never could.
They don't just survive the cold. They read it.
I asked one of the hunters how he knew which ice was safe. He said the ice tells you. I asked what it says. He said it depends on the ice.
That's not a koan. That's a statement of fact. Every ice formation is different. The knowledge isn't a set of rules. It's a relationship with a specific environment built over a lifetime.
I still have the parka. It's in a box.
Of course it is.
The comics wore out. I tried to get them resold in the States. The cobbler said he'd never seen anything like them. I ended up framing them.
You framed your boots.
They were good boots.
The thing about that parka, it was made for a specific person. The measurements, the fit, the particular way the seams were placed to avoid pressure points where cold could get in. Mass-produced gear can't do that.
The hunter who gave it to me was about my size. His grandmother had made it for his father. It fit me better than anything I'd ever bought in a store.
The Arctic is warming faster than any other region on Earth. What happens to a culture whose entire survival system is tuned to extreme cold when the cold becomes less extreme?
The 2018 ice crisis is the preview. When the sea ice doesn't form, the hunting economy collapses. The dog sleds can't reach the seal grounds. The knowledge system, all that accumulated wisdom about ice conditions, becomes less applicable because the ice itself is changing in ways the elders have never seen.
And you can't just switch to boats. The open water season is still only a few months, and the marine ecosystem is shifting too. The species the Inuit have hunted for 4,000 years are moving north as the water warms.
There's a deep paradox here. The cold that makes survival so difficult is also what makes the traditional way of life possible. The sea ice is a platform. Without it, you can't hunt. Without hunting, the diet changes. The diet changes, the metabolic equation changes. You import more food, which costs more, which requires a cash economy that doesn't really exist in the traditional system.
Daniel asked how people survive in the most consistently cold place on Earth. The answer is a whole system. Clothing, shelter, food, knowledge, biology. That took thousands of years to optimize and is now facing an environment that's changing faster than any human adaptation can keep up with.
The Inuggut didn't just endure Kuanok's cold. They made it their home. The clothing isn't just warm. It's a precise material response to a specific set of physical conditions. The diet isn't just what's available. It's a metabolic strategy. The knowledge isn't just folklore. It's a working model of a complex environment, maintained and updated across generations.
And the biological adaptations are the receipt for all of it. 4,500 years of selection pressure written into the genome, telling the body to burn hotter, store differently, build shorter. You can't fake that with a parka.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing and for the boots.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.